This meeting is now being recorded.
Hey.
Hi. Great.
So, if I could just start off, I want to thank you both very much for agreeing to this meeting. I know that you guys are super busy, but I'm really happy that this conversation is taking place because I think it's very important for the continuing work of the subgroup. And I understand very much the important role that ICANN Legal plays within the ecosystem. And so I really wanted to make sure that we can find avenues forward which are going to work for everybody. So thanks very much for taking the time and setting helping to set this up.
Well, we're happy to do it. So we've got your questions in your agenda, and we're happy to engage on it any way that's useful. The one thing I want to make sure of is that we're clear on what my role in the discussion is. So as you know, this is John Jeffrey, and I'm the ICANN's general counsel and secretary. And my understanding of the role that I'm providing here is that there are some specific questions that relate to the legal group inside of ICANN's role in the answers that the organization's provided, and to provide background on that in particular. And I think some of the questions, for example, are probably going to go to things that are broader organizationally than that. And so where that's the case, I'll try to point that out and make sure that we're not, you know, I'm not talking as the representative for all questions relating to ICANN, but specifically relating to those legal issues. Is that consistent, and does that make sense?
Okay, I understand that. I mean, I think that the part of the reason why some of the questions are a little broader are that I think some of them grow out of the previous conversation that I had with Sam Eisner, particularly around the for example, around the different policymaking work that ICANN Legal does. That's something that we sort of touched on in the previous conversation, and I was hoping to follow up on. But if there's areas that you don't
know, that's great. That's great too. But you know, in the question it says the legal work that we do on the policy. So that's an example of where I think we can talk about what work we do from the legal team side, but obviously a lot of the work we do is just supporting the board the board and supporting what they do on the legal piece, and supporting the policy support group and what they do on their work with the community. So I wouldn't be the authority on talking on some of that. So, but I'll point that out where it's useful.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. So can we just jump into it then?
Sure.
So I guess that's a good segue into the first question, which is on attorney-client privilege. Did you want to start? I mean, you see the first question is about the types of policymaking work, but if you want to just start by fleshing out your maybe providing a bit more insight into the comment that you made on the in the response, and then that would be all right as well.
And so on the comment, you're referring to the org response recommendation 15 requiring ICANN to proactively waive attorney-client privilege unless there's an ongoing or contemplated lawsuit or negotiation, creates a directive on ICANN's internal operations and practices that could impact resourcing and operations, that specific response, right?
Yes.
Okay. You're going to have to help me just a little bit in understanding how that we're trying to tie that question directly into that response. If you could give me, I haven't been in your earlier conversations with Sam or in the group's discussion, so if you could just elaborate a little bit more on what you're seeking so I know that I'm answering the right question.
Well, so more than anything else, I mean, I'm trying to essentially push towards an avenue to provide greater transparency around the work that ICANN Legal does. I'm trying to find an avenue to basically enhance transparency there without necessarily without jeopardizing your ability to operate. So essentially what we're looking for is to try to find avenues for greater transparency around the policymaking and support work that don't compromise your ability to play the more, if you want to think about it that way, classical legal function around litigation, litigation strategies, adversarial administrative procedures, and so forth.
Great.
So in terms of that, when you mentioned...
Sorry, we've got a little bit of a lag, so I don't want to talk over you. Go ahead.
No. I mean, I'm jump in at any time, because what I want to know is if you find that the current phrasing of this would impact resourcing and operations.
Let me go out to a broad point first, because I think that'll probably be helpful. And because there's a number of assumptions that I'm probably bringing into it, and you may be bringing into it, it might be useful to break some of that down and make sure we're what's been said to you before and what we presented is consistent with what we do and how we operate. So the first thing I would point out is I want to lay aside, you know, myths about what ICANN Legal does or what the ICANN General Counsel does, and just sort of talk about what we in fact do, and we've done a number of things to talk about that, and I think Sam's probably addressed it in some of the questions and some of the dialogue. What our primary role in policymaking is support. So ICANN Legal sets no policy. Our role is in two or three different parts of the policymaking process, but it's usually in a subservient role to other parts of the organization, or certainly subservient to the community in terms of how our involvement works. So as a starting point, when a PDP is formed, for example, we have a specific role, which is to help the supporting organization that's evaluating the policy work, for example, in the GNSO. There's a scoping question that comes back to ICANN Legal to the General Counsel's office, and we provide input on whether the proposed scope of the policy is consistent with what ICANN does, what ICANN's bylaws say, what is to be policy work inside of ICANN. So that's one of the only times we actually give an opinion into the policy work. And that opinion is publicly presented. There's no privilege around it. It's transparently provided. We say very clearly, you know, we think it is or is not within scope. Here's why. Most of the time, that is just a determination that it is within scope, because obviously most of the policy work that's generated in those sorts of things is about, you know, that's why everybody got together, because they're in ICANN and they want to set policy in the ICANN space or in the surrounding area. Where there's been a few instances across the years, so I'm going on my 14th year as general counsel, and I can think of two instances where we've said there was a question about scope. In those instances, at least in one of those instances, the GNSO ignored sort of what I said and went ahead and did the work anyway, and brought some advice back that was inside of the original scope of what we would have thought would have been within scope. So it's part of the dialogue. It's transparently presented. It's part of the public dialogue. There's no barrier on that. In other parts where we participate, our role is almost always just as someone advising within the general process. So I can't think of an instance over the last handful of years where we would have provided any information or not provided information because of privilege. So I don't have any of those instances in mind where we've said we would provide you that, but there's privileged information that we can't provide you. So I don't have a working example to describe to you. A great example of where we have provided advice has been in the general space relating to the transition. That wasn't really policy advice so much as it was specific questions about how ICANN conducts its activities relating to litigation or within various mechanisms, accountability mechanisms, or other things. And so in some instances where ICANN was involved in active litigation, we may have maintained privilege, but we wouldn't have just done that without consideration of, you know, the overall impact of where that information would go and how that would be used. Confidential information from time to time, we have provided advice not to provide, but that's usually where we've obtained third-party information from a contracted party, and we have a proactive obligation not to release that information. But, you know, I don't have any working examples where we've held attorney-client privilege to keep from providing information into a policy process. And so if you do, or you have some specific examples, I'd be very interested in that.
Okay, so first of all, that's very, very helpful. I don't have, there isn't a specific thing that I'm looking for because generally speaking, what I'm looking to do is to craft a rule, not a specific instance, right? And I realize that the instances are useful to informing how the rule should be structured. But more than anything else, it's great to hear that the privilege is not, if it doesn't seem to be being asserted in a way that impacts policymaking, then would it potentially, but your concern, if I understand you correctly, is more about the directive aspect of it. Would the concern that you mentioned be mitigated or avoided if we shifted it so that instead of crafting it the way that it currently is now, the recommendation says something along the lines of ICANN Legal should only assert attorney-client privilege in cases where its disclosure would be harmful to an ongoing or contemplated lawsuit or negotiation, or disclose confidential third-party information, or otherwise be subject to the exceptions within the DIDP.
Yeah, so I'm certainly not going to take an opinion on language that we're going to talk about on the fly in a conversation like this. We'd have to go back and look at it really carefully. But what strikes me from what you're saying is that we'd have to be, I mean, in our response we said requiring ICANN to proactively waive attorney-client privilege unless there's an ongoing or contemplated lawsuit or negotiation creates a directive on ICANN's. So I don't think we should ever proactively waive attorney-client privilege without having a factual scenario relating to that. There could be instances. I mean, so I think there's some interesting backdrops that we should put in before we even go into this in any detail. So one, ICANN Legal inside of the organization is probably one of the most transparent parts of the organization. We seek on a daily basis opportunities to provide additional transparency. It's not the opposite, the way that you would think that it might be in a typical corporation where the legal department is sort of riding over all the information and saying, you may release this, you may not release that. Before you put it in a public statement, we need to check it. That's not our role, and it's not the way that the organization internally works. It's, in fact, mostly the opposite, where we're the ones saying, why aren't you releasing that? Aren't you going to include this additional information? Why are you withholding an attachment or a document? When you look, for example, at the board work, the papers that we provide are the papers that the board's making a decision on. We release minutes that are not corporate minutes but are detailed descriptions of what's going on inside the boardroom. We produce materials that are the purpose of the decision, and we produce rationales after each decision is made along with the descriptions of the conversation that the board's taken on any issue. More and more, we're trying to push to having transparent dialogue where it's useful and there's actually deliberations of the board. So we're atypical in terms of like a corporate legal function. We're much more aligned toward the transparency aspects as being a benefit to the organization, because where ICANN shows its work, where it shows the way decisions are made and how those decisions are made, it tends to benefit the organization as opposed to the opposite. Because when we don't provide information and don't transparently produce materials, anyone can fill in those blanks and make up stories about what's actually happening behind the scenes. Where we can produce those documents and that dialogue, we're actually benefited as an organization because so many, every decision that's made, hundreds of decisions that are made every day are on the basis of ICANN's purpose, its mission, its role, consistent with the community, and serving the public's interest. So we're proud of that, and we want that to be displayed. So that's the starting point where we come from. When we stop put a barrier on any piece of information, it's almost always based on actual things that are going on, so threats of litigation, confidential information that we're required to maintain, but it's I can't think of an instance where we just put a cap on something because we want to say the attorneys worked on it and therefore it can't be produced. It has to. Attorney-client privileged information, attorney work product is labeled on things only when we think there's potential risk, and I think our temperament on that is probably very liberal as opposed to being very conservative.
Okay, that's great. And obviously we're in full agreement on the benefits of transparency. And I, you know, in terms of the current policies, my hope is that you're not seeing the recommendations or the process as any kind of attack or criticism on what ICANN Legal is doing or even what ICANN as a whole is doing. I think that based on what you're saying, what we should be looking for maybe is a codification of a positive policy, right? So maybe, like what you're saying sounds fantastic.
You're absolutely right, and I agree. I didn't read it that way at all, but what I'm worried about is where we say requiring, you know, what we're objecting to is making a proactive waiver without being able to consider actual facts involved. So there are going to be instances where policy crosses actual, you know, world events, life events that are going on that relate to litigation for us. And in those instances, we don't have governmental immunity. We don't have, any way of not having those sorts of issues result in lawsuits against the organization.
I fully understand that it needs to be a contextual determination. My hope is that that doesn't mean that we can't. My hope is that the need for context doesn't preclude our ability to sort of codify this or to set out values according to which that decision might be made.
Yeah. So if you go back to the recommendation that response was responding to. The DIDP exception for attorney-client privilege should be narrowed so that the information will only be withheld if its disclosure would be harmful to an ongoing or contemplated lawsuit or negotiation, and explicitly mandate the disclosure of broader policymaking advice received from lawyers. You can read that in such a way that I understand why we wrote the response the way we did. So when we're going specifically to the language and the response, we can be in violent agreement, but I'm not sure how we change our response.
Sure. Well, I mean, I suppose that, you've made your position very clear on not having a proactive waiver. I guess my hope would be, and maybe to try to get a place where we can move past this first issue, is that recommendation could be retooled in a way that it's more of a decision-making process on ICANN Legal side that relies on these contextual factors and should be based on particular guidelines as opposed to that firm waiver that you're seeing at the moment. And my suggestion would be like that I could redraft it, that we could redraft it and send you, I know you don't want to comment on new language of the fly, which I fully understand, but I could redraft that and send you a revised exception on that front, and maybe you could let me know if it resolves any of your concerns.
That sounds great, and I think, you know, I think you're going in the right direction. I think guidelines, which we're capable of applying to real facts, are valuable, and I think we operate within those already, so that's that'd be fine, and we're happy to look at that and respond to it.
Okay, excellent. So regarding the so if we can just then move on to the second point, or I guess this is bullet three, which is commercial information and open contracting. This is, as you can imagine, been probably the most actively debated issue in the subgroup. My hope is that we can push towards greater transparency in the contracting and clearer rules around the use of non-disclosure agreements as a way of kind of safeguarding the current exception for commercial information as it applies, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, and let me respond to a few things on this. So one, in terms of the current guidelines for use of NDAs, I think there's not a lot in terms of what is a guideline. I think what we do in terms of a practice is actually fairly conservative in terms of how we use NDAs. So I think, and I'll give you just a brief timeline in terms of how we've approached this. So when I first came on, there was a very liberal use of NDAs. So it was pretty much everyone we were talking to, they were using NDAs. It was in every discussion. And that really came from, you know, sort of having law firm involvement at the general counsel level and looking at it like a tech company. And we've fallen way far away from that practice. I don't know the numbers. I wish I had it in front of me, but we could probably provide some information on that. But the use of NDAs has diminished significantly over the years. And recently, maybe in the last year or so, we even did a stronger push to limit the use. So now I review each of the NDAs that we do enter into now, and there's only a handful that we've entered into, for example, in the last 6 months. And in each of those instances, we've required a commercial purpose to be stated by the party that's requesting it if it's requested from the outside. And we require a rationale for that. And if there's a request for an NDA to be presented from the inside, it's because there is information that we're sharing that is a third party's information or that would relate to information that might provide vulnerabilities in terms of security or other issues. So we don't use NDAs on a regular basis the way that a commercial entity would, and the use of it is fairly conservative. Now, that is not documented, so maybe there's an opportunity for us to put some documentation around that, which might be beneficial and show the practices that we're already committed to.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I guess this builds on the last one. Is that all sounds great? So let's codify that.
So I'm looking at the response. Represents a shift of ICANN's cognitive process could have significant impact on. So I think this is actually answering the question more broadly, right? Which is, ICANN should consider adopting open contracting. So open contracting, let's go to that for a minute. That's not a legal issue at ICANN. That is a financial issue or an organizational look at how the choices that are made based on business practices and benefits or detriments that come from open contracting. So you know, if I can adopt an open contracting standard of some sort, we'd probably have a view on that as the legal department, but we would have to act consistently with the rest of the organization. That would be more, you know, of how do we do it well, not whether or not we can. So that would be my role in that, and that's just advice I would provide to the organization on that. There's no legal barrier to an open contracting standard, of course, depending on what that open contracting standard is, because as you know from your experience, what that means can vary widely.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the reason why,
I was just going to add what it looks to me like we're responding to is that there could be a practical detriment in business to entering into contracts that way, and that's not really a legal issue at all.
Yeah, I mean, the general view on the people that work on these issues is that open contracting will generally bring should bring prices down and increase competition because that makes it easier for people to get involved. But that's again more of a financial issue than a legal one.
I'm sure you know this because you've had this dialogue with other team members and with ICANN staff. But we have an active procurement process that's published.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of good practices relating to how we contract already.
Yeah.
I just thought it was probably useful. I'm sure that you have that, but in terms of this being a recorded dialogue and the fact that we're making some record, obviously a lot of our practices relating to contracting are already open, and I understand that you're seeking a higher standard on that. And so my note on that, my role is that there's no legal detriment to that. This is primarily a financial trade-off issue.
And in terms of the financial trade-off, in terms of the cost of setting up the system, or in terms of the potentiality for an adverse impact in terms of pricing and competitiveness?
Yes, both.
Okay. Okay. So you also have concerns in terms of the costs of like administration and disclosure, like actually expanding the system?
Well, as you can certainly appreciate, and everything that is added to requirements at ICANN, of which we could probably outline hundreds in the last year, adds to administrative costs. And certainly part of my role as a manager at ICANN is to worry about our fiscal responsibility and make sure that the benefits that come from some of our requirements match the detriments that come from additional bureaucracy and processing on the front end. So I don't know, and I haven't done any evaluation of this, but I assume that this would, if we, depending on the open contracting standards we would adopt, there would be an increased level of bureaucracy and auditing around that would certainly increase our team's workload. So there would be a direct cost. In terms of the second question, I have been involved with contracts that have been negotiated for ICANN over time that when we told the parties that we were contracting with, we would need to disclose the amount of money that was being spent. There wouldn't be any way to not show that. When we were being asked to not show what they were charging us, they said, oh, we'll have to charge you a normal rate then. Because the parties that we were engaging with didn't want to show that they were providing a different rate to nonprofits or organizations than they were providing to their commercial customers. So I think there is some real impact on that. Now, how great that is, you know, I wouldn't even dream of speculating on. That would be something you'd have to talk to Xavier and the finance team or the operations team to understand.
Okay. Yeah, I can certainly appreciate both of those. Okay, I understand that. But going back to just what we were talking about just a second ago, I think that it would be good to still codify practices around NDAs, and so I'll go back to the working group and we'll try to bring up some potential values. And again, like the question on attorney-client privilege, we'll maybe send back suggested redrafted languages, and you can let us know if that alleviates the concerns that you mentioned, or if that properly reflects what you feel a good practice would be, or how that relates to what's being done.
Sounds great.
Great. So in terms of then the third major issue that I hope to discuss, that's on the duty to document. And I'm just trying to bring up right, recommendation 2 as written could mandate a specific document management practice. While proper record keeping is essential, document retention and maintenance practices designed to organizational needs are matters of operational excellence and legal compliance, and not solely transparency. So I guess I was a little bit confused when I read that, in the sense that I'm not sure, and I agree that there are matters of operational excellence, but is that, I'm not sure how that would preclude an expanded documentation process, or if there's, I would appreciate any more insight into that response.
Yeah, I'm not so the recommendation that it's working from, correct me if I'm looking at the wrong one, the DIDP, it's relating to the DIDP specifically, or it's relating to a broader?
The duty document would be included within the DIDP, but it would relate to a general document management process.
So this says the DIDP should include a duty to document whereby ICANN staff are required to create and maintain full and accurate records in an accessible form so as to be able to be used for subsequent reference, containing adequate and proper documentation of the office or authority's organization, functions, policies, decisions. And then the response that you were reading said that the broader recommendation could be read to be a mandate of a specific document management practice. So I don't think it says that there's any objection to what you're saying in the recommendation generally, but it's saying if, as written, it mandates a specific document management practice, then there could be an issue. So I'm not so sure it's objecting to the concept that there's a duty to document. We already have a duty to document. We certainly, have that duty as it relates to our litigation, as it relates to policies that would impact third parties, as it relates to whether we're acting within the scope and authority of what we are as an organization. So there's all sorts of fiduciary and other obligations that require us to document. There's actions and liability that could come against the organization if we didn't do that. But I think if you read the recommendation, and some could read the recommendation to mean that we have to do it in a certain way, then we were raising a potential concern about that. So it's more about, having been through a number of these reviews, we realize that some people are going to read very specific actions to come out of general statements. And so we just wanted to make sure we were responding that, depending on how someone read this and moved on it, it could mean different things. And obviously different parts of our organization document things in different ways because they're very different types of records, different types of involvement with the community. So much of what we do is just already out in the open and public. What we don't have out in the open and public, we've been working on, for example. So as you're probably aware, we've been working on better document management systems, more professional ways of looking at how the organization collects and manages that sort of information. We've been looking at ways we can improve the website and the transparency of information that's available on it. But all of those are very big projects and have long windows in terms of how those improvements come in and the cost that's involved with getting those things right.
So am I understanding you correctly in saying, again, as I draft the statement, we're doing the recommendations, I mean, I'm sure that ICANN does itself have documentation requirements. I mean, that's just solid business practice. The specific sort of context behind this and behind the duty to document as it exists in certain systems is to avoid people trying to subvert the transparency systems by resorting to things like oral conversations or keeping things off the record. Not to suggest that that's the case, but again, it's just about codifying a strong practice. But am I correct in reading what you just said as saying that this is something that's done, but that the DIDP wouldn't be an appropriate place to regulate this, or that there are different standards within the organization that aren't harmonized?
I don't want to disagree with what you said, because I didn't hear anything wrong with it, but I'm not sure that that I would attribute it the same way you would to what I was saying. What I'm really saying is we are broadly transparent in how decisions are made on a whole variety of fronts. And we have documentation of decisions at the board level, at the executive team level, where they reach thresholds and other things. And we continuously produce strategic documents and measurements against that, budgets and measurements against that, all sorts of things that have a lot of information in them. And we're an organization that's grown from, 150 people 5 years ago or 6, 7 years ago to almost 400 now. And with that are all sorts of complexity. There's all sorts of new complexity to how information's managed and shared. Plus we have, 1,000 plus people that participate on a regular basis with ICANN on its websites and in its policy processes and in the various working groups and parts. And information is asymmetrically complex in ICANN because of the complexity of how the organization works. And so we have an information management team and communications team and legal and policy development and the executive team and all sorts of different parts that are continuously engaged in how to make information more accessible and how to make it more transparent. So I think the concern we have is if someone said out of this recommendation, hey, you should set up this document management practice this way and it must run that way. One, would that be the best path to do it? And two, what would the cost implications of doing it that way be? And how would we even manage that across the different forms of the way that information is utilized and collected across the organization? So it's, if we were, a normal company that had 300 people and we were, all the information was contained in one system and we didn't have thousands of people from the outside involved in various pieces of that, it might sound really simple. If you look at it from the context of what ICANN is and how it operates, it's a much more complicated concept. Document management is a much more complicated concept inside of our organization than it would be in other types of organizations. So if you're talking about document management and legal, easy, you know, that's
sure.
Totally non-complex. If you're talking about document management across the whole organization, I can't even imagine how to create a singular system that operates across all of those spheres. And so that is part of what the organization's what the management team's struggling with in terms of how to build the right systems to maintain document management, to make sure content management is appropriately managed on the websites and through points where the community can access it. And so any standard that gets set on that has to take into account all the different types of information, how that fits the hundreds of thousands of documents that are produced and how that would work with it. So I know that's a, you know, not the answer you were looking for based on what you were saying, but I think that's the framework from which I'm looking at it, and reading the org's response, you know, that's the framework from which the org response was written, that it's, we have no problem, we're working continuously on how to make sure decisions and actions and the work that's being done is documented, but it's more complex than saying, hey, you should have a document management system, it should work this way.
Sure, and I do understand very much the concern that you mentioned about the statements and the idea of the duty to document being open to different interpretations, because it is a big idea, but I also want to make sure that I'm hoping that I think that narrowing it is also a good idea in the sense that I want to make sure that there is something actionable and not open to different interpretations. So given that the general notion
if you said generally we have a duty to document, I don't think no one would disagree with that. If you say you have a duty to document and you must do it in this way, the in this way part is a critical element of how to evaluate this.
Okay. But I kind of want to avoid, I think it's important to avoid things that are too open to interpretation, because in addition to letting different people push them in different directions, that limits the degree to which it's actionable. So what I wanted to suggest as an idea is, given that the broad notion underlying this, because this is not an attempt to try to harmonize data management standards across ICANN, which I understand is going to be challenging. The idea that's underlying this is to reduce the idea of people trying to avoid a paper trail. So if it was a narrower and more specific statement saying something along the lines of where oral conversations are a component of a decision-making process, are a major component of a decision-making process, ICANN staff should take steps to document them. That's more narrow and specific. But it's also not necessarily a broader harmonization. And again, I know that you'd want to see the language before approving that, but before offering anything specific. But do you think that that might mitigate the concern?
So let me make sure I understand. So the primary concern in this is that ICANN staff might have oral conversations that could result in decisions, and that there's some concern that that's not documented?
Yeah, that there wouldn't be a paper trail. And I say, again, it's not about – I'm not trying to push this onto ICANN staff. This is just sort of better practice.
No, I get it. I mean, let's use that as a great example. So so if we looked at what kinds of decisions could be made at that level, I'm trying to imagine, you know, something that would be without a use case, it's really hard. But for example, if it's a financial expenditure, then there's a requirement for documentation, there's a requirement for contracting, there's controls in place that exist, you know, in any organization like ours. If it's a if it's a decision relating to how we would implement a policy, there would be a writing generated that would say what our position was. Most of the time that would be put out for public comment or shared with the group. Excuse me. If it were I'll give an example where we would want to restrict it. If it were strategy relating to litigation, then we would actually even be documenting that, but that would be documented in a way that it might have privilege around it. But I just don't know what the use cases are of the things that would happen in that way that wouldn't already require additional documentation. So I guess I'm struggling with what problem we're solving.
So it's not about the additional documentation. It's not about whether or not the process is documented. It's about making sure that all parts of the process are documented. So on to give a procurement example, right? Or imagine a particular employee was up for two or three candidates were up for a promotion, and you have the paper trail leading into it. You have the resumes, the written discussions, the minutes of the conversations, and then before the decision is made, one of the people on the decision-making panel pulls the other aside and says, "Hey, listen, this person's a good friend of mine. I'd really like to boost his score a little bit. Can we find a way to do that?" Right? And again, not suggesting that that happens, but it's about ensuring that if something like, if a conversation that's part of the decision-making process happens, there is a requirement there to have that kind of documentation as opposed to, so that people can't get around the system, if you see what I'm saying.
That's a fine example, and so we would have all sorts of obligations to already do that where it would bring in some capacity for legality or other things, but I have no problem with the general concept that if there's a critical element to a decision that is, that should be captured in order to show how the decision was made, that we should have a process for documenting that. That makes complete sense to me. Maybe that's along the line of what you're suggesting,
Great. I mean, that's great, and it can certainly, I think we can work to redraft it so that it addresses that issue more specifically and is less open to interpretation.
I guess what we worry about, though, is like if it says every private conversation, you know, needs to be documented, that's probably not a practical thing. If it's relating to how the decision's made, that's a whole different thing, right?
Absolutely. But, we're 100% in agreement on that.
What you're saying makes complete sense to me. I think that's of great value. That's the kind of thing you wouldn't have a lawyer in an organization like ours that wouldn't agree that we would want all reasons for decisions being made being documented.
Great. And obviously we don't very, very aware of the concern about burdensome and writing every little thing down, and that's not the road that we want to head down. I mean, that's always the concern involving duty to document type stuff. Sorry to go back to that idea, to the broad
idea.
That's
no
always the concern. Very understandable. We want to do this in a way that doesn't impede ICANN's ability to operate, obviously. We don't want to reduce functionality. We don't want to create unreasonable or problematic administrative burdens. And certainly we want to draft in a way that is understands that everybody's busy and you don't want to be writing down every private conversation.
Good.
All right. So in terms of action areas going forward, I'm going to report back to the working group, and we'll discuss avenues to try to redraft those three specific recommendations to try to in line with the discussions that we've had. I'll mention briefly.
I had one question though that would be. So I'm interested because I have this problem as well, as you can imagine, when When we look out at some of the community interactions, of course, they occur in the same way that you're talking about. In a non-public or recorded way, a lot of decisions get made, you know, in the hallways or in private discussions. Are these sort of standards that we're talking about in terms of how they apply to the organization, are they also recommendations that will be applied or that might be suggestions of best practices for the community?
So that's been done more generally. There's a different working group that's looking at how the stakeholder groups' interactions and better practices for transparency among them. I've provided a little bit of input into that, but generally speaking, as I understand our mandate is we're just supposed to be looking at ICANN, the organization, not extending it outward. That being said, like, I agree with that. My own role on the executive committee of the NCUC, I've been pushing for more transparency. Obviously, I mean, I'm a true believer in this stuff. But generally speaking, my understanding of these recommendations is it's just limited to the organization, but I agree that there should be. I would generally apply the same standards, yes, but I'm not sure that that's within our mandate at the moment.
Got it. I just wanted to understand. Thank you.
But
I think these are, you know, there are some great concepts here. I think that there are opportunities. You know, we spend a lot of time focusing on the organization for good reason. There's resources and money and employed people and all sorts of issues. But where a lot of the interplay with these sorts of issues really occurs, where you have active and present conflicts in a policy setting, and that exists in the community spaces and could be great benefit to have some of these guidelines and transparency rules also apply into those spaces where the policy is actually set, as opposed to where it's implemented. So that, you know, just an idea, and if I can be of any help in your raising those issues at those other groups, I'd be happy to help with that as well.
John?
Well, I completely agree. I think that the thing to do on that front would be to, I'll raise it with the working group and see how they respond. I mean, there's been a little bit of there's already been back and forth about being sure to stay within our mandate and being sure to ring fence what we do. And there is, I think it's Steve Del Bianco is leading a different working group that is addressing this issue, which is another aspect of not intruding into what other working groups are doing, because they're talking about direct accountability for the stakeholder groups to the public. A process that I've put some better transparency recommendations into. But as a general rule, yes, I would agree with that. And that's potentially something that we can follow up on in terms of expanding the applicability of the recommendations. The DIDP doesn't apply. Does the DIDP apply to material that's passed around in the stakeholder groups?
Well, in terms of ICANN's access to it, so the organization's access to it, yes. In terms of whatever we would have access to, that would be included, yes. But if the records aren't created, then we don't have any way to access it. So it's the same kind of thing. Like, we would, if somebody raised a question and said, for example, you know, provide all the documentation you have about how this decision was made and included across all these different platforms, then we would seek information from policy support and others about any information they had from lists or other things that weren't public, and would look at that as part of how we would reach into that to see that. But if there's no affirmative obligation to ever collect that information, then that won't be present on lists, whether those lists are public or confidential.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's why I was raising it, because there are probably, you know, any number of different ways that the community collects information and publicly provides it. There are also private lists and other places where lots of decisions are made. And some of the critique of ICANN organization relates to the underlying work that goes on among the parties in the supporting organizations and working groups in various places where the policies are getting set. And we don't have transparency into all of those pieces, nor is it useful for us to in all cases, but it may be where there's questions raised, like where there would be questions raised about staff decision-making, community decision-making, and the transparency around that is also important.
Okay.
Great.
Yeah, I completely agree on that. That's very interesting. I know we're almost done the chat, but just so quickly, I will bring that back to the working group, and I think I'll also raise that with the SOEC Accountability Working Group, which is definitely dealing with that. So in terms of the idea of providing written records for things, that's, I think, certainly something that that's worth following up on.
Michael, this is Bernie.
Yeah.
On the SOEC accountability, there has been a fair amount of work on this. And so, but just to say that they've had their first reading of their final report, and I believe next week is their final reading. So I think we're a little later, but to JJ's point, I think there are a lot of best practices that have been recommended in there around those things, and I think that should encourage you versus what you were looking for. They're to a point where they have had some pushback from the SOs and ACs and have tried to amend accordingly, but they are pushing the envelope. Thank you.
Yeah, I talked to Steve a little bit about the having a set of exemptions where information can't be sent out. But in terms of I'll go back to the report and check that out. Thank you.
Thanks, Bernie. I'll be sure to look at that too.
Great.
Excellent.
So we're just about at 6. So again, I'll go back to the working group and redraft. And discuss redrafted recommendations on the three things that you mentioned. And if you have anything to add, I'd be very happy to hear it. But thanks very much for your time, and I really enjoyed this conversation.
I want to take advantage of everyone being here relative to the implication of the ombudsman on DIDP requests that we're talking about. Does legal have any thoughts on that? And I'm being very selfish here because I'm involved in writing the ombuds final report.
So Bernie, so we're on the recorded part of the conversation relating to the questions that were set on the agenda, but I'm happy to pull off and have the discussion with you separately if you want.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, I have that on my on the list of things that we were, I think, going to pare that back in terms of the discussions with the complaints officer. I think there was a recommendation about that, and we were going to, on recommendation 19, we were going to revise it based on that.
All right. Well, then I guess we're covered. Thank you.
All right. So thanks again, and have a great day. Look forward to following up.
Thank you. Enjoyed the conversation very much, and thanks for all the work you're doing. Very important stuff for ICANN.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Leaving the meeting.
Michael Karanikolas.
Leaving the meeting.